The world is a warm place these days. It's March 27th in Duluth, Minnesota, where I live, and we haven't seen a natural snowflake since early December, until just a few days ago. We have snowmaking, and we've been skiing on the same 1 to 2.5 kilometers through it all, through weeks on end of 50-degree sunshine. The snowmaking has survived for our community to host the U.S. Spring National Championships, only to have nearly 2 feet of snowfall on the final day of racing. It's weird. I'm also a track coach, and you'd think the long stretch of 50-degree sunshine days in February would elicit pure glee from my runners and me. But even they felt the oddity of it all, nervous to celebrate it, I think, because it feels wrong. As a skier and fan of the sport, I'm in a quandary, despite having labored more than a decade with other enthusiasts in Duluth to be prepared for this very scenario. Snowmaking is a necessity for cross-country skiing now. But how should I feel about that? After all the hard work to be ready for the worst, I'm not sure how to feel having done just that so successfully in Duluth. Recognizing that beating Mother Nature might have gotten us here in the first place, I thought Bill McKibben might have a good perspective. This episode of Threshold is brought to you by Aaron's Co. Nothing takes the work out of yard work quite like an Aaron's. From comfortable zero-turn lawnmowers to deep steel deck walk behinds, they quickly get your lawn back to beautiful so you can get back to enjoying your weekend. The Aaron's family has been building durable, reliable machines in Brilliant, Wisconsin since 1933. Not many manufacturers can say they're on their fifth generation, and even fewer remain in the same town where they started. It's something Aaron's is certainly proud of, and it shows in every machine that comes off the line. Visit Aaron's.com, that's A-R-I-E-N-S.com, to find a dealer near you. If you don't know who Bill McKibben is, obviously you're not a golfer. Just kidding, gratuitous Big Lebowski reference. Bill McKibben is an author, environmentalist, and activist. A former staff writer for The New Yorker, he's also the author of 19 books, mostly focused on the human condition in the natural and man-made world. Bill's is a perspective unmatched and widely recognized as one of the most prominent, lucid leading voices of human-created problems on planet Earth. His 1989 book, The End of Nature, is regarded as the first book for a general audience on climate change. He is founder of 350.org, an international movement of ordinary people working to end the age of fossil fuels and build a world community centered on renewable energy. He is also the Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at my alma mater, Middlebury College in Vermont. He is also an avid cross-country skier and huge ski racing fan. Sad to say, he arrived at Middlebury long after I graduated, so I never got to experience him as a professor, but I'm glad to say that we met this winter at the Minneapolis World Cup. We exchanged pleasantries, and after a simple ask, which I think is my first use of a Middlebury connection as a favor in my entire life, but I did it for you, the listeners, to get Bill to come on the Threshold. Because I had questions, and I always love a discussion about ski racing from fresh perspectives and insightful people, categories in which Bill falls comfortably into. So with that, Bill McKibben, welcome to Threshold.
Hey, what a pleasure to be with you, friend.
Oh, it's great to have you. So let's just start with the context bringing us together for this interview, which is cross-country skiing. How did you become a cross-country skier?
Well, I'm not a great athlete, Chad, and never have been. But I've spent my whole life living deep in the woods, either in the Adirondacks or in Vermont, and I love winter above all else. And I love it, I think, most of all because it's the season when friction surrenders its remit on the planet for a little while and you get to glide across it. And so beginning in high school, I learned how to cross-country ski, and I've done it my whole life. About 20 years ago, maybe 25 now, I decided to take a year off from failing to save the world. To do a book that ended up a book called Long Distance. And for a year, I basically trained at a very high level just to sort of see what it would be like. And I spent a lot of time with the U.S. ski team and all yeah. you know, in those days, like the factory team and all those guys, Ben Huseby yeah. and so on.
Yeah.
And it was great fun. It was a fascinating book because my father got sick and died of brain cancer in the same year. So I was kind of charting my ups and his downs and thinking a lot about bodies and what it means.
Yeah.
But I, since then, I've, there are people who, train in order to race, and then there are people who race two or three times a year in order to justify the fact that they're out there training all the time. That's very, the second category is very much me. I don't mind racing, but I get out every single day. I live about 10 minutes ski through the woods from Breadloaf and the Middlebury College ski tracks, and so that's where I spend my time every day, including this morning.
I know those trails well as a Middlebury grad myself. I skied 2 years there, but I mean, you jumped ahead. I was going to get into long distance, but as long as we're into it, let's do that, and I can circle back on other questions. But how did that book come about? What told you to write that book about skiing at that time in your life?
Well, I really was burned out. After, by that point, probably 15 years of just all-out work on climate change, which is, I mean, not to sound sorry for myself, but a somewhat difficult task because you're dealing with existential crisis all the time, and you somehow have to figure out how to beat the fossil fuel industry, which no easy task, which we'll return to. But, and I just needed... I was turning 40, and I figured I was getting towards the end of the period when I really had a chance to see what my body could really do, given half a chance. I'd never been an athlete really growing up, know, and so I was interested in that, and it was extraordinary fun. I got a coach up here in Vermont, a guy named Rob Sleemaker.
I know Rob.
He invented the, you may recall, the Vasa trainer.
I used it. I used that Vasa trainer,
somewhat medieval torture device, but great great machine to allow you to double pull, you know, kneeling on a pad and things. And but he'd coached the biathlon team, so he did some coaching with me. And then, as I say, I ended up... I went out to West Yellowstone and hung out with the factory team, and I ended up in. I spent the summer in Australia skiing and racing there, and and ended up the book ended up in Norway for the Norwegian Birkebeiner, and ended. Which was a few days after my father's funeral. And so it was a voyage in all kinds of ways. Now, he had me on Rob had me on, I think, about 800 hours of training that year that I was doing it, which was probably not highly recommended for just kind of jumping into it. And since then, I've relapsed to about 500 hours, I'd say, since, just at a nice, steady pace.
That's still plenty, though. That's still a lot of training.
Training. I go out and ski, and I do my, intervals once a week and my tempo once a week and whatever, but I'm not as I confess I mostly do it because I just, above all, I love the motion of cross country skiing. There's never anything else that I've ever anything else I've ever done outdoors that has quite the same for me. Just meditative power. Classic skiing above all for me.
I agree.
To skate too, but classic skiing, just I can fall into the most beautiful of trances. And for some reason, though I'm clumsy and awkward and things, my body's actually pretty good at that. And I've always loved it. And I love to be able to, it just, it explore and get out there. Where I live, mm-hmm. I'm very lucky because you know Ripton, Vermont. Yeah. We do have these 50 kilometers of groomed trails at Ryker, at Middle Ridge, but we also have the Catamount Trail, which runs basically through my backyard, that runs the length of Vermont, and we have, you know, another 50 kilometers or so of ungroomed trail that people have hacked out in the woods of Ripton. And then we've got another 20 kilometers of snow machine trail that often is the best skiing of all. If you if you hit it right after the grooming, man, there's nothing that compares with skating on a beautifully groomed snowmobile trail.
So, do they allow you to do that in Vermont? In Minnesota, we're not allowed to ski on the snowmobile trail just from safety perspective. It's against the law. Do they allow you in Vermont?
It's possible that the Forest Service might not encourage it, but you know, it's a big town with, you know, very little, very few law enforcement personnel. So if that's my worst transgression, I've been to jail now a dozen times or so, Chad, but not for skating on the snowmobile trail yet.
Yeah, well, it'll make headlines when you do. So I want to keep talking about the book. Just looking back, I think it's 24 years old, the book. I mean, I read it all those years ago, and I kind of thumbed through it again just to prepare myself to have you on. And I feel the thing you did perhaps better than anyone I've ever come across is I feel like you brought the non-competitive cross-country ski enthusiast into the realm of what makes us ski racers kind of tick. And that's what I think is kind of special about it. I feel a divide is, you know, I've worked with the Cross-Country Ski Club here in Duluth and other cross-country ski clubs, and there seems to be a divide between avid recreational cross-country skiers and racers often, that they don't see things and have the same goals in a ski club setting. But I think long distance brings kind of all skiers together in a very human way, and I just was wondering, was that a goal? Was that kind of an underlying goal for you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I really wanted to understand. I really wanted to understand the appeal of this, because it's a very counterintuitive proposition that there'd be something appealing about the enduring pain, which is really the job of a endurance athlete of any kind. And since Nordic skiers are the, you know, most involve more muscles than any other thing, it's probably the most pain you can figure out how to do. And understanding what the delight in that was took a little while. Yeah. But once I understood it, then I had a sense that for me anyway, and I think for many people, it's that sense of total absorption, of losing the chatter in your brain that otherwise dominates our lives and it's impossible to escape, and just being fully, absolutely present there where you are. Now, could I hold it for very long? Not that long. You know, my mind isn't perhaps strong enough, at least in that way. But it makes it, among other things, it makes it all the more remarkable to have some sense of what's going on, to go watch the people who are really good at it. When Jesse Diggins descends, as she says, into the pain cave, when she spelunks down into that pain grotto as deep as anyone has ever gone, I at least have some sense of what it is that she's undertaking, and makes it that much more splendid to watch it happen.
I refer to it as scrubbing your soul on the washboard of endurance sport. You know, like, you know, and I have to say, Bill, one of the things, you know, I don't train very much anymore. I do get out to ski some. I mountain bike a little bit more than that. But I think, though, there's something about the what I miss probably about my 20s the most is the fact that you're with your thoughts for such a long portion of the day in which you can't really escape them. And you get to know yourself in that way, and I'm assuming that's something that you got from your project.
Absolutely, and it's a thing that's harder than ever in our world, because every one of us now has this goddamn square of glass glued to our palms at all times. And so how the hell do you ever escape, you know, how do you ever get to know what you actually are thinking about anything, you know?
All right.
I love being outdoors anyway. I've always lived deep in the woods. And so being outdoors helps with me that, but it doesn't, it's not by itself enough to sort of turn down the internal CNN that's always broadcasting there in your brain. The thing that sometimes really overrides that is just absolute being on the edge, and pushing. And so I have a feeling that's still why I go out and do intervals, once a week. It's not because I'm under any illusion that I'm going to get fast someday. I think that it's pretty clear that ship was never going to sail. But I do enjoy that exertion.
So, yeah, I mean, this is great. The book was written in 2000, so it's 24 years old. And it's quite personal while keeping kind of the universal sense of endurance as a value to the human experience. And that's likely never to change. But since then, a lot has changed in skiing since you wrote the book. And you have probably changed quite a bit too, as you kind of suggested. Do you ever feel the urge to revisit a new book on skiing, or at least skiing as a libretto for another topic from Bill McKibben of today?
I keep my hand in just by writing about it occasionally for the New Yorker or someplace. I'm afraid that my whatever talents I've got at this point, I've pretty much got to devote to this fight over the climate that's become the consuming preoccupation of my life. But what a great pleasure to be able to every once in a while get to write a little bit about this world. Yeah. And so I try every year to write a piece or two for somebody, also because it just always breaks my heart that there's never any, you know, aside from the 2 weeks of the Olympics, never any national attention at all on what is the, you know, what are the greatest endurance athletes America's ever produced.
Yeah. I think that's a good insight. So let me just ask you really quickly, how did you end up being the voice of and face of climate change? We'll switch gears a little bit.
When I was, my first job out of college, Chad, was writing the thing called the Talk of the Town column for the New Yorker magazine, which is as urban a job as it's possible to imagine. I've just traveled around the city profiling interesting people and things. My boast at one point was that I'd gotten out at every subway stop in New York City. while I was doing that, I wrote a long piece for the New Yorker about where everything in my apartment came from. I followed every pipe and wire back out. So, you know, Con Ed was buying oil from Brazil. So I was in the rainforest in Brazil looking at oil wells, and up in the Arctic looking at hydro dams, and on the New York City water supply system, and on and on. And I wrote a long piece, which they turned into a Nova special and things. But the thing that was important for me about it was, and this would have been about 1985, that it let me understand in a visceral level that we lived on a physical planet. Mm-hmm. I'd grown up in the suburbs, which are a kind of machine for hiding the workings of the actual world from anyone.
Right.
And so I had no idea, you know, it never really occurred to me, like, where the water came from or whatever it was. And now I had this sense, not only that the world was a very physical place, but also a fairly vulnerable one. Like, even a city as rich as New York depended on, a few critical things going right and rain falling in the right places and things. So when I started reading in the mid-1980s, some of the first academic papers on climate change, they hit me harder than they otherwise would have, I think, having that fresh understanding. And so I wrote a book in 1989. I wrote the book in 88, and it came out in 89, a book called The End of Nature, that was the first book, I guess, for a general audience about what we now call climate change, what we then called the greenhouse effect. And maybe because it was the first, it did well. It was came out in 24 languages and was a bestseller all over the place and things. And so at the age of 29, I somewhat unintentionally found myself grappling with this problem that I think there's little doubt is the greatest problem that our species has ever wandered into. Mm-hmm. And while there are lots of other things I would have loved to go on and write about too, the stakes are so high around climate change that I have sort of kept at it. Intellectually, it's an extraordinary challenge too. So it's very interesting. I mean, it encompasses everything, you know, economics, political science, theology, chemistry, physics, engineering, psychology, sociology. So it's a powerful way of looking at the world. And so that's how I got started sort of obsessing about it.
Yeah.
At a certain point, about 15 years in, not long after that skiing book, it really began to become clear to me that writing another book about climate change was not going to sufficiently move the needle. We had won the argument about climate change. It was clear to everyone who was paying attention what was going on and how dangerous it was. We'd won the argument, but we were losing the fight because the fight wasn't about reason and data and evidence. The fight was about what fights are generally about, which is money and power.
Right.
And the other side in this fight, the fossil fuel industry, had so much money and so much power that they could lose the argument but just go on winning the fight. And that's when I decided we needed to try and start building movements. There really hadn't been much of a climate movement. I started at Middlebury with 7 students this thing called 350.org, taking its weird name from what the scientists tell us is the most carbon we could safely have in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million, a number we're tragically north of at this point.
Right.
But probably because there was an unfilled ecological niche, 350.org took off like a rocket. We've now organized 20,000 demonstrations in every country on Earth except North Korea. We helped spearhead the fight against the Keystone Pipeline. Mm-hmm. And then we launched this big fossil fuel divestment campaign that became, by some measures, the biggest anti-corporate campaign ever. We're at about $40 trillion now in endowments and portfolios that have sold their coal or gas or oil stock. So it's been... You know, those things have, I've had to learn how to do all that. That's all been volunteer work for me, which, you know, I'm grateful for the fact that I live out in the country and it doesn't cost all that much to live. And you know, what are my expenses? Basically, Zach Caldwell sold me my first new pair of cross-country skis in a decade this past year. So, you know, cross-country skiing also has, if you don't insist on using high-end wax all the time, it's a pretty, I think my ski pass is $189 a year. And as of today, I've skied 127 days this year. So I'm getting my money's worth, you know. Those are the things that allow me to be a volunteer in this work. But it's been super interesting to kind of see how power works and how sometimes you can figure out how to challenge it.
Yeah, I think that you segue perfectly into kind of where I wanted to go next. And you know, your celebrity is rooted, as you point out, in a pretty dense scientific, philosophical, existential, and serious human stuff. But you're remarkably light, as this interview points out. Your written and spoken voice, as well as in real life, you're very light. You have a light touch, and I think that makes you very approachable, and people listen. Is that something that you've had to work on, or do you think that's just who you are by nature?
I think that I probably have a somewhat different voice, writing and speaking. When I write books, I mean, I hope that they're highly readable, but they're also, I mean, unavoidably, unavoidably pretty serious. And so when I speak also, but there's no point in I've learned over the years, I think there's no point in being, all that sober all the time. And, you know, when you're, I mean, the stuff that I have to deal with and talk about and explain to people and stuff is by its nature so grim and difficult
right.
that it's important to figure out some ways to let people in and have a little more air around it. It's one of the reasons when we organize, we're really, we use a lot of art and music too, you know, because that opens up, you know, I always forget which hemisphere of the brain is which, but environmentalists have been good at working on the side that likes bar graphs and pie charts, you know, but that's only and that's important. As I say, you have to win the argument, but winning the argument isn't sufficient. You also have to be able to motivate. We have to be able to motivate each other to then go do the work to actually make change happen.
In all your work, how do you think being a skier and loving skiing has affected the way you approach what you do?
Well, first thing I will say is, I mean, there are obviously several thousand more important reasons to fight climate change than the fact that it's going to render Nordic skiing extinct activity before the century is out.
But
for me, that's certainly one of the motivations, you know? Mm-hmm. The thing that I most love to do in the world is also arguably the, along with diving on coral reefs, probably the most endangered. The EPA did a report some years ago on the future of Northern New England in a climate change world. And they said, and I'll never forget reading the sentence, this was probably 15 years ago, by the latter part of the century, snowmobiling and cross-country skiing will be extinct in New England, and alpine skiing will exist on a, you know, one-month season on north-facing slopes or, you know, some such. That pisses me off. pisses me off because I love the whimsical. I've always thought of nature as, of winter as this whimsical moment when, as I said earlier, friction just disappears and you get to glide across the surface of the earth. And I know that not everybody thinks that and they're like, oh, you know, it's hard to drive or something. But I have no sympathy for people who don't like winter. It's magic, you know. It's the completely magical moment. And I'm always a little resentful when April comes around and we just kind of grind to a halt again in the mud.
Yeah.
You know? But so that's part of it. I'm constantly reminded of how beautiful a world we were born onto and what fun it is and what a pleasure to lose it, what a sadness to lose it. The other part of it, I guess, about skiing is that working on a problem this large is by definition an endurance sport of its own. And there's no possibility of quick reward. And so you have to be able to gird yourself somewhat and equip yourself psychologically in that way. And I think that endurance sport actually does a pretty good job of helping you with that, and it certainly provides a good ongoing metaphor for all of that. And it's not that I'm not interested in other sport. I kind of am. I watch baseball and things and pay attention. But over the years, my love for endurance sport has just gotten stronger and stronger and stronger. And I think it has to do with that enduring interest in character and what allows people to endure. Because I think it's a crucially important life skill, especially in a society that's, you know, ever more geared to just doing easy things fast.
Because of their love for snow, Aaron's has been a proud sponsor of the U.S. biathlon team since 2019 and recently created Aaron's Nordic Center in Brilliant, Wisconsin.
This four-season outdoor recreation center provides event and programming opportunities for all ages and includes a robust snowmaking system, a 5K lighted trail network, and infrastructure for biathlon, cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, roller skiing, inline skating, running, walking, and winter fat tire biking. The Trailhead building provides a great space for pre- and post-activity fun, a retail shop, and light food and beverage options on the large patio overlooking the trail network and sunsets. Learn more at aaronsnordiccenter.com. That's AAriensNordicCenter.com. We connected this center in Minneapolis at the World Cup, which is, by all accounts, really a magical time for U.S. skiing. But after we chatted, I thought more deeply about the event against the dismal lack of natural winter we all experience. And you mentioned there that the lack of snow access for you, your personal skiing at the time while in Minneapolis was being threatened by not having access to a place to ski possibly there. So I just tell me a little bit about the streak you were talking about and what was it all about and has it continued or is it over?
I don't have an obsessive streak where I have to go out every day, but I just pretty much do every day go out and ski. But I will confess that I count the number of days most years that I've gotten to ski. And I'm always happy when I, as I did last week, pass 122 because it means I've skied for a third of the year. And that always seems like a reasonable, you know, I wouldn't mind having been born in Sustian or someplace where I could probably ski for 170 days a year or something. I like it that much, but I'll take what I can get. And many, many thanks to the people at Reichert here in Middlebury and at Craftsbury and the other places around New England, at Garnet Hill and the Adirondacks, Mount Van Hovenberg, that let me ski as much as I do.
Yeah, and I should point out that all those places you're talking about have snowmaking, which is the point I want to get to next. I've been central to the snowmaking cross-country venue here in Duluth that just hosted the Spring Nationals, and I think we started over 10 years ago, that process, and it took a lot of time. And besides being expensive, the material, water, and the electrical infrastructure on top of the design and the political will of the people to invigorate stakeholders to complete such a project, it's a significant cost, and all to make up for something Mother Nature simply can't be relied upon to do anymore. And due to the issue you are most expert in, global warming. So I found myself wondering how you feel about it. And more importantly, I wanted to perhaps get a better sense maybe of how I should feel about it, or maybe we as a ski racing community should feel about snowmaking. Is a World Cup like Minneapolis on 3.3 kilometers of snowmaking something we as a community need to scrutinize more from an environmental perspective?
Well, so this is always an interesting set of questions. Mm-hmm. Look, Americans by nature default to individualism in all things. And so confronted with climate change, their first questions are, what's on my roof? What's in my garage? Mm-hmm. You know, what about my skiing hobby or whatever it is? Mm-hmm. Which is fine. Mm-hmm. But truthfully, we're well past the point where we're going to deal with the climate crisis one Tesla at a time, one vegan dinner at a time, one whatever it is at a time. The most important thing an individual can do is be less of an individual and join together with others in movements large enough to make fundamental change in the basic economic and political ground rules. Mm-hmm. Among other things, energy, dirty energy should be expensive and clean energy should be cheap. And to the degree that we can make those things happen, they'll help shape what kind of, you know, whether or not we decide to, say, make snow and what we use to make it with and so on. I don't think anyone should obsess too much about the fact that, I mean, I watched this absolute jackass of a senator try to make Gus Schumacher feel bad in the Senate last week when he testified about climate change, trying to make him feel bad for having taken a jet to Europe to pursue his job, you know, as a ski racer. That is not useful. It's extraordinarily useful for Gus and Jesse to be doing political organizing to try and make things change. And the fact that they're doing political organizing is precisely the reason that this senator from Louisiana, who's taken more money from the fossil fuel industry than anyone except Joe Manchin, was so eager to try and go after him. That's the real place. I'm happy that I have solar panels all over my roof. Mm-hmm. I'm happy that they connect to an EV. I'm happy that I can walk out my door and ski into the woods, whatever. But I don't. This is not how we're going to figure out whether or not the planet warms another degree or not. It's going to warm another degree or not, if depending on if we can break the power of the oil industry and move quickly to renewable energy. One of the things that's really interesting is that we now have, the engineers have really done their job. It's not like we're in an impossible situation. They've dropped the cost of solar power and wind power 90% in the last decade. We live on a planet where the cheapest way to make energy is to point a sheet of glass at the sun. We're still used to thinking about this stuff as alternative energy. And I think people think of it as like the Whole Foods of energy, you know, good, but this is the Costco of energy.
Right.
The only reason we use oil and gas is because the fossil fuel industry is dominant enough to keep us from changing quickly. Mm-hmm. But we could. And there are people who are trying, and God bless them to one degree or another. The Biden administration came up with several hundred billion dollars to help make this change happen some, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not enough. We're not going fast enough. But it's not impossible. So, it's... It's a good time to double down on that kind of political engagement. And if at the end of the day you then go ski 2 kilometers on some, you know, ice that someone, you know, spit out of a gun for you, don't worry about it.
Yeah, okay. It's great. Great answer. Let's talk a little bit. Let's go back to skiing and some fun topics. Let's talk a little bit about you as a ski fan. When did you start following what was going on at the top of the sport? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think really when I was doing that book was the first time. I'm not even sure I really knew much. I'd known that Bill Koch had existed and things, but it was in the course of doing that book. I mean, I started meeting people. I interviewed Johnny Caldwell and, you know, the sort of people who'd been the pioneers of this stuff. And I, since I lived in the Adirondacks before I lived in Vermont, I got to know a certain number of people up around Lake Placid, which is another one of these centers of, you know, high-end skiing. When I did my first race I went to do, and it was the beginning of this book, was up in the Gatineau. They used to have this, I forget what it's called now, but it used to be called the Cascanada, this race up there. And I went up there, and my friend Jack Burke was up there with me, and he'd brought his son Tim, who was then junior high school or something, I don't know, and his friend Lowell Bailey, and he was, you know, same age. And they were like, oh, here, we'll wax your skis for you. And, they were good skis. And, and then they told me, it was a bitter cold day. They said, do you have wind briefs? And I'm like, what are they? and I learned in the course of that. But so, you know, I knew like Tim and Lowell, who went on to be the best biathletes that America had ever produced. And then right around that time, we moved to Vermont, and I ended up at Middlebury as a scholar in residence. And became the faculty advisor to the Nordic ski team. Every team has a faculty advisor. I was not the coach. They had obviously great coaches, Terry Aldrich, and then the great Andrew Gardner, and now Andrew Johnson. But I got to know all the skiers over the years, and so I got to watch, you know, a pretty good pipeline of people who went off to become high-level skiers. You know, Garrett Cuzzy and I mean, Matt Whitcomb had left by that point, but his brother Jake was skiing, and Kate, his sister, for the Middlebury team. And then Simi Hamilton came through, and that was pretty much a revelation to watch him ski. And, yeah, you know, and so, of course, once you know people, then you start paying attention. And we started really watching. And for a while, of course, it was extraordinarily difficult to even to find out what on earth was going on. You know, now thanks to you and so on, which, you know, it's the weekend ritual at our house. Sue and I settle in to watch the ski races at some point. And we're bitterly disappointed when the last one of the year comes around. And although I must say, the last race of the year this year, this year was the single most exciting year to be a ski fan that I've ever remember, including any of the Olympic years or anything else. I enjoyed every minute of it. And partly because partly because Minneapolis was great. We can talk about that. But also just because without an absolutely dominant presence, at least on the women's side of things, like Johag or someone, and without the Russians, who I have always thought of A as doer and B as probably doping, it's just fun to watch the whole thing. And and Jesse Diggins is one of those once in a lifetime athletes that you get to watch, and she's surrounded by remarkable people: Rosie Brennan, Sophia Laukley, who was in my global warming class at Middlebury, and so it's great fun to watch her emerge as a star. And also from all other places around the world, I love watching this woman Skistad from Norway. I do not understand what it is she's doing, because she appears to be going half as fast as anyone around her, and yet somehow she teleports herself across the line ahead of them all. It makes no sense. Chad, when I was in Minneapolis, by accident, I just ended up staying at the same hotel as all the skiers, and I went down to the gym and was on the elliptical and looked to my left, and there was Skistad on the next elliptical, and she was going slowly on that too. I couldn't figure out a way to just say, how do you do what you do? So I just, you know, said, thank you for all the pleasure you're providing everyone.
That's great. Yeah, she's not a big talker, we'll put it that way.
Yeah, it's the other thing I like about her.
So tell me about your experience in Minneapolis. I think that Minneapolis is a pretty transformative for all of us. And, you know, what's your takeaway? You know, what was your favorite moment and what was your takeaway from Minneapolis?
Well, first of all, it's such a pleasure to see this here close to home. I went up a few years ago to watch the races in Quebec City, which I love too, and Alex Harvey's swan song on the Plains of Abraham there in the middle of Quebec City, and I wrote about them too at the time, and that had much of the same feel for me, because there's this strong emotional storyline. I mean, and Harvey coming home, and in Minnesota, I mean it was almost too. I mean, it really was like it was scripted by some, you know, mediocre screenwriter. There's been no snow on the ground all year. And then Jesse Diggins flies home, and at the hour she lands, it begins to snow, and we have the first snowstorm of the year in Minneapolis. I mean, even the Hallmark movie guys wouldn't sort of stoop to, well, they might, but that's sort of, you know, sort of where it was. But the other thing that was just amazing about it for everyone who was there, including the European skiers who were, to a person, I think, sort of overwhelmed, was the level of just raw emotion among the fans. You know, I think probably people in Falun and things more or less take it for granted that this is going to happen every year, yeah. And they're going to get. When Jesse, I was out early on whatever the first morning was of that thing.
Saturday. Yeah, it was the qualifier. That's right.
And so about an hour before the qualifier, or an hour and a half, people were out skiing warm-up laps. And so this was early in the morning in Minnesota. I mean, it was still, you know, 8:30 or something. But there were already a huge number of people on the course. And Diggins came around on a warm-up lap, and she started up that big hill in this just wave of sound. It was like a physical force. You could see her just as it kind of pushed her back almost. You know? And you could see her start to cry. And it was like, wow, this really is, you know, this sort of combination of the story of her and the pent-up demand for seeing our stars close to hand and this snowstorm that has fallen and on and on and on. It's just too magical. And then the fact that Gus went out and won a race was crazy.
He just throttled that course. It was amazing.
I mean, standing out there watching the race, you could tell that he was skiing really beautifully.
Yeah.
And it was really fun to watch I got down to the finish after, you know, about when he did, because I could tell he was having a race and I wanted to see what. And it was fun to watch him finish. And it was really fun to watch the Norwegians come across and pay their respects, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And
clearly, like, you know, all wanting to win, but happy that, very happy for God. I mean, Clibo. Mm-hmm. We're blessed by the fact that the great athletes in our sport of our time are also seem to be great people.
Yeah,
Clibo came across and immediately just went over to give Gus a hug and say good work, you know.
He did let out a WTF though, like before that. Like he looked at the scoreboard and like you saw the WTF come over his lips, and then he then he kind of caught himself and realized he's in America and went over and congratulated him. But it's true. I mean, it just shows you that he is a great competitor, that he wanted to win. He's like, how did I not beat Gus Schumacher?
You know?
And then it started to become clear to all of them that this was a special moment for American
skiing.
Obviously,
something weird, you know, there was some magic in the air that it was no use. And then So I was standing around in that Finnish corral there, where reporters stand. But I'm not, I was covering it for The New Yorker, but they don't obviously don't care about, you know, getting the immediate quotes about, you know, whose wax was working well or whatever, and so I was just standing back and watching. And I watched Gus come through talking to all the reporters, but I was just standing back, and I could see out of the corner of my eye Jesse Diggins standing there waiting for him to get out of the mix zone. And she probably should have been out warming up, really, because the women's race was about to start, but she waited 10 minutes for him to come through and so she could give him a big hug. And he said, "You have a good day," you know, he said to her, as athletes do. And she said, I think I was the only person close enough to hear her say, "I already had the best day," and tear up a little bit again. And that, I mean, as a reporter, that was good. That was made my story. But it was, you know, she wasn't saying it because, I mean, she didn't know I was there, and she wasn't saying it for any other reason. She was, you know, she clearly sincerely meant it. And then to watch her go out happily know enough about skiing to know, among other things, that when it's heating up like it was that day, starting 59th or whatever she was, is not an advantage. That course was breaking down, and I did not think, A, there was any way that she could ski particularly fast on it, and B, you know, just that the toll of the emotional toll of the last 72 hours must have just done her in. But the fact that she managed to hold on for third there and beat Svahn was one final piece of magic And certainly presaged the fact that she was going to be able to hang on and beat Svahn down the stretch.
Yeah, yeah. It ended up setting up a very dramatic end of the season. It was great. Yeah, really great. And so then you think about Jesse. So one of my questions, I wanted to do a couple of kind of wind things down with a couple of get to know Bill the skier short answer questions. I did this with your friend and a guy I know you like, Devin Kershaw. So I'm gonna end with you the same way. So just a couple of short quick answer questions. Who's your favorite skier all time and why?
Oof. My. Well, I mean, I get to go skiing once a winter or so with Bill Koch, which is always extraordinarily fun for me. You know, what a great pleasure. And I love, but I confess now, I really do love watching Diggins ski just because of the, I mean, I know that, you know, she always says she's not technically that good a skier, though obviously she's gotten to be quite technically good. But just the fact that she runs on fumes so much of the time is remarkable to watch. So I love, I'm very grateful to live in the age of Kleibo and get to watch somebody reinvent the art of skiing. I will say, I also loved watching when he was here at Middlebury, Simi Hamilton ski.
Yeah.
Because he was such a remarkable natural athlete. The only person I've ever watched close up who, as they got faster, you know, the faster they went, I remember watching him occasionally practice starts, you know, and most people, when they try to go really fast, start to flail. And he got his body got better at whatever it was doing, tighter, more. And I think that's true of a lot of the really great skiers to watch. It's fun to not be Chad, to have never have had any illusions about being a great athlete oneself, because it really lets you appreciate without any, even the slightest hint of sort of jealousy or anything, the people who are brilliant at what they do.
Yeah.
And this is such a, it's such a beautiful sport because I remember once being some, you know, some occasion or something where there was some moron from the U.S., you know, some one of these donors or something who runs the U.S. ski team or who used to do it badly. And, you know, of course, all they care about is alpine skiing. And and he was just saying, oh, you know, Nordic skiing, it's, you know, it's not very hard, or, you know, whatever he was, you know, not technically. The thought, you know, the fact that these guys are able to go 60 miles an hour downhill on super skinny skis and then turn around and go right back up the hill in ways that would break any other human being on the planet is such a, it really is no sport like it that I ever have come across.
Yeah, it's great. It's great insight, and I think that is the compelling the compelling point of the sport is so nuanced that it's hard to break into that America you talked about earlier, where we have a screen in front of our face and easy things are readily available to us. That's why your work is
really important, and I will just say you and Keegan have done a tremendous. I think that, I mean, I'm sort of weird that we have to watch it on this app, you know, from the Snow Ski Association. But you and Keegan have done a you're obviously great at this. And Keegan turns out to be a fantastic color person. And you guys are exactly the right balance because, you know, you're always on the edge of, you know, overexcitement, and and she errs on the side of, you know, flatlined, you know, sobriety at all times. And it's a remarkable combination. It just works super well. And it's, I mean, too bad for you guys that you're not, you know, it's not, you're not, what you're good at isn't football or something, because you'd both be rich, you know, doing this. But we're very, very grateful to you all for doing it.
Thanks. What's your favorite regular spot to ski? Like, where do you ski regularly? What's your favorite
spot? Well, I ski at, when I lived in the Adirondacks, I skied at a place called Garnet Hill all the time, which was fantastic. And when I ski here, when I'm not out in the woods, I ski at Breadloaf. And it's one of these, the race course here was built by John Morton, like so many others in New England, with a lot of consultation from Andrew Gardner, who, and so it's a beautiful course, you know, when you, when the snow is good and you can ski it right, it's hard and challenging, but you can, but you can make the corners, you know, and the climbs take a lot out of you without pushing you quite over the edge. And so I cannot tell you how grateful I am for it every day. The Green Mountains are a special place.
What's the most magical place you've ever skied?
Oh, that's a very good question. I mean, I love that country up above Lillehammer, obviously, and things. But 1 year, long ago, I made it to Iceland for the last ski race of the year, which is in April in a place called Ísafjörður on the, and you ski up into these glaciers and things, and it's complete magic. And then you, when you finish, there's like a, the people in this small town have, you know, there's more cake and pie than you could possibly imagine, and you know, smoked salmon and beer, and the season really comes to an end. Cool. So there, under the, by that point, long sun in April, up on the glacier in Ísafjörður, has to be right up there.
Okay, and where would you like to ski that you haven't skied yet?
Well, I'd love to go skiing sometime, and I don't even know where you're supposed to go, and I've tried to find out, but I would love to go and ski wherever Japanese people ski, in Hokkaido area.
Yeah, I've been there.
There's got to be a Nordic ski area there someplace.
Yeah.
And I hope you'll send me the, you know, the website or something, because I've, I love Japan, and it's, I've always wanted to get up into those mountains. And,
yeah, I've been there. I went there in 1991 when I was still a junior. We didn't go to the World Junior Championships because of the war in Iraq that year that had broken out. But I got to go to the Miyasama Ski Games in Sapporo. And we competed on a military base because it was biathlon. So I didn't really get to go out into the country. But that was really an awesome cultural experience. And there's a lot of snow there. The UP has nothing on Hokkaido, we'll put it that way.
Well, if anybody knows where to go skiing in Japan, let us both know. So, because
all right, sounds good.
That'd be great.
Okay, and who's your favorite writer?
Well, that's that's a much harder even than picking my favorite skier, obviously. Let me say that a writer who's been of extraordinary importance to me, I mean, there's a thousand, 10,000 answers to that question, and just brilliant people, Naomi Klein and Rebecca Solnit and Robin Wall Kimmerer, and, you know, people. But the writer that probably did more to reorient my life than anybody else was Wendell Berry, and the Kentucky farmer, essayist, novelist, poet. And if anybody listening to this doesn't know his work, then you're lucky to get to discover it from the beginning.
Well, I don't know him, so I'm going to check him out. Thanks. I figured I had to take the literary question there in there, because you're going to know that better than me by a lot. And then final question, what's better, a great book or a long ski?
the great book by the fire in the evening after the long ski is really the way to go. And with a, bottle of something good close to hand, Vermont Vermont has more breweries per capita than any place on the planet, Chad. And
wow,
most years, one or another of them wins the title of the best beer in the world. So it's true that the planet is deteriorating quickly, but the stuff that we can put in our mouths is better than it ever was. There are an extraordinary number of great writers rising to the moment, that so there's a lot of great books to read. And though winter is disappearing, it's a reminder to us all never to take a snowstorm for granted. If it snows, then get out and make the absolute best use of it you possibly can. That's important.
That sounds like a mic drop to me, Bill. Bill McKibben, thanks so much for being on
Threshold.
Thank you
so much, brother. A real pleasure. Take care, man.
I wouldn't call myself an environmentalist, and I'm certainly not an activist, and I'm not a wealthy elite. I like to think I'm a practical guy. My wife had been researching putting solar power on our house for years, and in 2016, with all the incentives at the end of the Obama administration likely to get slashed by his successor, we went for it. We'd done better that year, and while we had to stretch, we were able to pull it off. Now it has paid for itself. We have free electricity, and we sell our excess electricity back to the electric company. It was a good investment, but it wasn't easy, and we needed a slight windfall to do it. Imagine if as much time and energy has been spent to make solar and EVs more affordable as has been spent on making cheaper, more powerful internal combustion car engines, or harvesting wind power, or any other green solution with less negative impact on the environment. Imagine if we didn't have to stretch financially and we could all readily make that switch. Even just more of us. In simplest terms, it's what Bill McKibben has dedicated his life to, and he's still so gracious about us not doing more individually, because it's systemic. He chides the system and the lack of will by the individuals at the top of such a system. He gets it more than most of us who don't have the superhuman spine he's needed to be the target of the most powerful corporate lobbies in the seats of power around the world. I've spent 0 days in jail fighting for what I think is important and right. That kind of backbone can feel like judgment, just at face value, of what most people would go through to stand by their convictions. But his is not a motivation of his activism over anyone else's, that's clear. And that makes all the difference. He remains so gracious and understanding of human nature, which is almost intoxicatingly fresh to bump up against in this day and age. He is not personally benefiting in the material sense of what he does. He clearly gets a lot of personal satisfaction in his work, though, and that's not nothing. In fact, it might be everything. But in capitalistic terms, Bill ain't getting ahead in his line of work. I point that out only as counterpoint to the American notion captured by the fictional Gordon Gekko that greed is good, which is probably at least a great fundamental of this whole global warming thing in the first place. Bill McKibben has proven to be beyond reproach of what I would consider reasonable, thoughtful people, and he deserves more celebration than he gets, which is a lot. He is famous for his work, after all. But after a winter like this, it's still not enough, especially if you're a skier. That realization struck me the first time I shook his hand. So as this frustrating winter comes to a close, it felt right to thrust one of our own into the spotlight and highlight that among Daly, Bjergen, Northug, Johaug, Klabo, as our sports greats, and in context to Diggins, American cross-country skiing has another global skiing star who isn't perhaps a competitive favorite, but someone who is proving to be a superstar in at least as much and maybe even more meaningful way. After all, without winter, there are no skiing stars. So thanks to Bill McKibben for his love of our sport, his exhaustive life's work, using his talents in such meaningful ways for the good of us all, and for his time to join us today. That's Threshold for this episode. I'm Chad Salmela. Thanks for listening.